good morning.
George, how are you doing?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Well, good, buddy.
That's good.
So what I wanted to do is, if you're comfortable with this, is now or tomorrow or in the coming weeks, have one or two or three conversations with you.
Okay.
For history.
No problem.
Okay.
I want to go to trace the history of the whole thing.
Well, anything. It's, I mean, part we want to talk about, obviously, in some cases with pioneers, certainly such as yourself and Mike Murphy, how did you get started in this? Because your own story, as you know, is it's a MGM motion picture. I mean,
it's quite a story, and it's I have so much material, I don't know how I could ever get it in, because the history itself is very, very interesting.
You were influential in founding the Human Potential Movement, and certainly in naming it. You go back to your time as an editor of Look Magazine. How could it?
Magazine.
Exactly.
During my time in Look, we had just absolutely monopolized the national awards until it became embarrassing. Those are great days.
You heard about this sort of wacky place out in California, Esalen, and it was kind of like an offbeat human interest story or something when it started, wasn't it?
Well, actually, I had been covering education. I'd actually won 12 national awards, unprecedented, I guess, even today, on education reporting, among other things. I covered the civil rights movement, the Cold War, went all around the Iron Curtain, the whole thing. But education, I kept coming back to education. And,
yeah.
After a while, I won so many awards, I said, if the educational establishment is giving me these awards, I must be doing something wrong. So I got to thinking about the human potential.
They shouldn't be patting you on the back quite that hard.
I was being too good.
Yeah.
Too good, boy.
Yeah.
I realized that our schooling was not really eliciting even the tiniest fraction of the human potential.
Yeah.
And so I started out on this story called The Human Potential, just simply that. That was the title. And that, I started on my coverage in about September of 64. Well, by February, I had already interviewed 37 experts. Well, number 38 happened to be a guy named Michael Murphy. And the way that happened was, I had finished the first 10,000 of what I'd planned to have, is a 20,000-word article, which is a short book, you know. And when I finished the first 10,000 words, I gave it to Lois DeLacha, who was a brain researcher at Mount Zion Hospital and a friend. And she gave me a brief critique, and she then said, listen, for a long time I've been thinking you've got to meet Michael Murphy, and now you're going to meet him. And he's coming up, and he's having dinner with me tonight, and you are coming, and you cannot say no.
Said,
okay, Lois, anything you say. And so that night, I walked in, and I was ushered to the kitchen where this guy, this Murphy guy, was back there eating cheese and crackers. And so we start talking, and within 5 minutes, a magical thing happened. It was all the, you know, usual getting acquainted stuff. We just kind of went right through that, and the first thing you know, we're talking about this human potential thing. And the whole thing, our studies, his and mine, fit together like very, very fine cabinet work. Just fitting together perfectly.
And it has for 40 years.
Yeah, dovetailing.
Yeah.
And the rest of the people who came to the dinner, I don't even know who they were. They just sort of faded away in the background. And so we talked until everybody had left there, and then we drifted over to my house.
Now, how old were you then?
Let's see, how old was I? 65. I was 43.
And he was what, in his early 30s?
He was in his early 30s.
Yeah.
He's 9 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
So we continued talking until 2 or 3 in the morning, and at the end of that, we were standing there in my old Victorian I was living in on California Street, in one of those 1886 houses.
I love them.
Fireplace.
Absolutely love them.
Excuse me, that couldn't be reproduced now.
Yeah.
It was getting really quiet and a little cold. We'd forgotten to turn the heat on, you know.
Yeah.
It's February the 2nd, 1965. Mike turned to me and said, George, let's fire the shot heard around the world. I said, okay, let's do it. Just very casually. And from that time on till now, we have been working together.
That's fantastic. So where did it go from there then?
Well, it just, I mean, it went into many different articles, many different articles.
And your own trajectory then, though, you kept going back to California, Mike was doing the Esalen thing?
Well, wait a minute, I should really say that I was in California. I had an office in San Francisco. I was a senior editor and West Coast editorial manager.
Got it.
So I was already there. And it already picked up on a lot of stuff. I did the very first story I ever done on the Beatniks.
Yeah.
In the National Magazine.
Yeah.
And I was following lifestyle stuff pretty closely. In addition, civil rights movement is a thing I really am proud of, my coverage during those years at Look, 17 years. But anyhow...
Was that that must have been paralleling then, because the civil rights movement really, really hit its stride in the late 60s, so...
Yeah, well, exactly. You see, I got the idea of the human potential really from the idea of the civil rights movement. I was brought up a Southerner.
Yeah.
I knew what it was like. I knew that there were people of my father's generation and even of my generation at that time who truly believed that if one nigra, as they used to say,
yeah,
you know, not nigger, but nigra,
yeah,
got in the same schoolroom with their daughter, they would die before that could happen. And they truly, truly believed that. And by 1965, I was seeing that... changes were occurring which were unbelievable. I was there in Atlanta when Piedmont Park Swimming Pool, which I used to go to when I was a kid, I was brought up in Atlanta. So when it was integrated,
yeah,
and black and white bodies in the same pool,
yeah,
and the rednecks standing around the edge with a weird look on their faces, as if they were seeing little men from Mars. I mean, the civil rights movement was so powerful, so huge. Now let me just get just a little further along.
Sure.
3 weeks later, no, actually, it was the very next weekend, I went down to Esalen, and we were introduced to some of the mysteries of Esalen.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, Mike came up and spent a long weekend with me. So during that weekend, we talked about what we were going to do in the future, you know. And we did a brainstorming session about possible changes that seemed really quite unusual as of then.
Yeah.
And as we were going along, suddenly I said, wait a minute. There is a civil rights movement. There's a free speech movement. Why shouldn't there be a human potential movement?
Yeah.
And, you know, you in brainstorming, you just write the thing down and throw it on the floor. By this time, our floor was already covered with snowstorm, you know, covered with white papers. And I just took it and threw it down there, never realizing then, by writing that thing and throwing it down there, that it would eventually become somewhat of a movement that, one way or the other, for good or for ill, influenced really millions of people.
Yeah.
So...
Well, I think it was, though, if you look at the human potential movement, I think your point is really well taken, that the human potential movement and the civil rights movement can be seen as part of a broader unfolding, a broader evolutionary unfolding, if you will, where we're basically finding higher, deeper, wider potentials that are not only in ourselves, but obviously therefore exist in society and in the world at large. And nowhere was that seen more clearly than when I expand my circle of identity from my ethnocentric, redneck, white, not just white, almost any racial bias. I can include more and more people, more and more sentient beings in an embrace of consciousness and compassion. And that was a living embodiment of that in the civil rights movement. And although they're not often thought of as similar, the meditation and contemplation and interior human potential movements were in fact of a piece with that broadening, deeper, wider consciousness that was trying to be born.
You've got to, if you're really going to be integral, you've got to also involve social and political movements.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
The civil rights movement was so amazingly successful, especially on the Black Power thing. It all became a little mixed up. But the early days of Martin Luther King's work and what was happening, the desegregation of all the schools down the
right.
South, it was a miracle.
Yeah.
And we said this, and of course that's part of the human potential,
yeah,
that black folks also have fantastic potential.
Right.
All human beings do. And we're using a tiny, tiny bit of it.
And environmental protection was the same thing. It was another sweep of things that ought to be given care and consideration and concern.
Well, by 1969, we had the gay rights movement.
Yeah.
The feminist movement.
Yeah.
It was a period, of course, that was vitiated by the Vietnam War. That kind of ruined a lot of stuff. But still, it was a huge thing.
You were also, at the same time you're covering the, let's call it the political quadrant, so to speak, you're also looking at the interiors. And, of course, Esalen was not, quote, merely interior. It had a lot to do with political outreach, Soviet-American relations, and so on. But it certainly concentrated on interior encounter groups and growth and development as well. And so did your own interest focus on that.
And, you know, the idea of the human potential movement came out at the same time the media blitz hit Esalen. And so, therefore, the kind of a skewed notion of what it was all about. For millions of people, the whole idea of the human potential movement came to be associated with people crying and weeping and hugging each other and cavorting nude in the hot bed.
What was that movie, Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice?
Yeah, even a movie. We were dismayed. I mean, we were amused at first, but then dismayed. And so I said, Mike, we've got to unname this movie. Seriously. And we found out it's much harder to unname a movement than to name it.
Yeah.
But, in the early 70s, that was not what we had in mind. I mean, we thought of the human potential and everything that you might do in life and social change. But that's what we thought about.
Well, exactly. And you can't act on your human potential if human potential is the ultimate thing that's in the closet.
Right, absolutely.
Well, as you know, my own kind of analysis of that whole period, both the incredible strengths and the downside of the shadow elements that came in, is generally what I call boomeritis. And, of course, it had this wonderful, and still has wonderful, many, many positives. But like all movements, there's shadows and downsides and stuff that comes in that really wasn't part of the original intention, usually. Sometimes it's just unintentional consequences, sometimes sets things in motion that are attracted to a movement like that that aren't really a part of the movement itself, but end up giving it a pretty bad name in general.
Right.
So what was your first suggestion for an unname?
Well, no, we didn't. We just kind of kidded around.
But now,
what we basically did is quit talking about the human potential movement.
Yeah.
And just went on with our work. And, you know, now it's coming back. It better come back right now, because God knows this is what we need. All of the illnesses and sicknesses throughout the world for the fact that we're not using our potential.
Yeah.
Very, very dangerous.
One of the problems, in a sense, too, is that some of the human potential movement wasn't integral. So it founded a lot of really good potentials, but because it wasn't really integrated in a broader scope, including the importance of political and civil and environmental action, then it can get lopsided. And
well, that also happened at Esalen, you know. Because Mike got the idea of having a residential program, a nine-month residential program.
And yeah.
It was very, very integral. The education of the senses,
yeah,
of the body, of the mind, it was right across the board. But this very charismatic person, Will Schiff, came in 1966. He was the leader of the residential program, and he was a avid backer of the idea of encounter and the Big Bang experience, where people would come to some kind of catharsis. It was all very cathartic. It didn't last. Now, you know, these catharses did work. They were true, but the quick fix,
they didn't stick.
It doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing I think about the past 30 years is we learned a lot of things that worked, and just as important, we learned a lot of things that don't work. I mean, learning is trial and error, and you can learn just as much from the errors as you can from the successes. And the cathartic, explosive encounter moment was fantastic, and it's part of a group of things, of course, that are known as peak experiences or an altered state. But altered states have to be converted into permanent traits, and that involves practice and development and usually stages or waves of unfolding and development. And that means integral transformative practice, not merely a weekend, you know, whoopee session.
That's right. And it also emphasized the body and especially the emotions. But actually ended up sort of denigrating mind, the idea of mind.
That was the other problem, wasn't it?
Not much spiritual in it. Like down at Esalen, I would see signs people would put up on the wall, get out of your head and get into your body. Lose your mind and come to your senses.
Fritz Perls.
I would take those signs down.
Yeah.
And it was very, very, it was limiting. And there was also some negative fallout on it.
Well, and part of that, this anti-intellectualism, it wasn't trans-intellectual, it was anti-intellectual.
Absolutely. That's the way it fell out with the average person who came through it.
There was a real false dichotomy created between experience on the one hand and intellect or mind on the other, that somehow the two were opposites, whereas actually, as you know, you can experience senses, you can experience your mind, you can experience spirit. There's no split between them like that, and that anti-intellectualism really haunts a lot of places that grew up then. It's very prevalent in Europa. You can find it at most of the alternative universities. It's really unfortunate. There was a two-part quote from Oscar Wilde that I always liked. He said, nothing can cure the soul but the senses, and nothing can cure the senses but the soul. And we forgot the second half. It was sensory awareness. Lose your mind, come to your senses. And unfortunately, a generation pretty much lost their mind, and it was really unfortunate.
No, and so Mike and I, we were always, we kind of stood back from that. It was a powerful force. I guess it's something that we had to do. In a sense, you could say that it was a long overdue response and reaction to years, decades, centuries of repressiveness and injustice.
I agree.
And, you know, I gave Dr. Price Cobb, a black psychiatrist, and I gave the first interracial marathon where we would start, we would have a Friday evening session at Esalen, and then we would start at noon on Saturday and go straight through till noon Sunday. They'd bring meals into us. They were very explosive. We did break through racial barriers, but again, it didn't last. We did that for quite a while, for about 2 years, and it was exhausting and exhilarating work. And, you know, all these things probably had to be done. We had to go through this. But all the time, we had a vision. Mike had a vision. It was definitely integral. My book, Education in Ecstasy, My School of the Future of 2001. It had a dome just for meditation and the spiritual work. It had a body dome. It had intellectual work. It went right across the board.
And obviously, it would include civil rights and the environment and the whole shebang.
And the political and social actions.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever lost that vision, and I think probably we wouldn't have gone as far as we did though without some of the excitement, the breakthrough, the response to that. But anyway, then we began very, very early on trying to move towards the integral in almost everything we did. Mike, in 1976, of course, began his study of extraordinary human functioning, the collection of this huge database, and that was across the board. In 76, I had started Aikido in 1970, and at the same time, I started Leonard Energy Training, use some of the principles of Aikido and things that I had learned at Esalen and elsewhere through my research to create a ongoing class that lasted from 76 to 82. And it was in 82 that I did something myself at Esalen, an 8-week intense certification program in Leonard Energy Training. And
well, I remember that happening. What was your sense about the results of that?
Well, again, it was very interesting. You see, my reaction was that these little certifications, I was disgusted by these New Age certification programs, have two or three what they call intensives. I hate that word. intensive what? You know? And I wanted to really do something more like boot camp.
Yeah.
My wife Annie and I went down to Esalen, and we were there for 8 weeks. We did 6-day weeks, 16-hour days. I think back in that period with exhaustion and exhilaration.
Yeah.
Really, it was across the board. We started at 6 a.m. Couldn't speak from 6 a.m. till 9:30 a.m. We started with meditation. Annie, you know, was a Zen monk. So we did that. Then we had sword practice from 6:30 to 7 to 8. Then we had breakfast. Then they had about a half an hour before the first class. We had classes where people learned how to do these exercises. It was very, very intense, very exciting. Halfway through, we had 2 days of trials and ordeals, and these were real ordeals. In other words, this was a tough, tough program.
Yeah.
And so this was tough. But again, you know, that type of intensity didn't quite do it. Even though it was long term, it was not long enough, and it didn't.
Because it's really year in and year out, isn't it?
That's it exactly.
Yeah.
That's what we finally realized.
Yeah. Part of what an overall integral model, and there are many wonderful integral models, but all of them have a couple of components that are important. And two of the most important, it strikes me, are states of consciousness, including altered states and peak experiences and encounter explosive moments and all of that, which are incredibly important, and in stages of consciousness. And those take years to unfold. They're permanent acquisitions. They're enduring acquisitions. They take at least as long as learning how to play the piano or learning French or learning any skilled discipline. It's count on 5 years at a kind of minimum. And it, the same is true for meditative states and states of really gaining access to these deeper, wider, higher spiritual potentials, not just as a peak experience, which you can literally do very authentically, you know, by having certain types of encounter movements or even psychedelic drugs or shamanic experiences. You can very definitely have authentic peak experiences, but to make it last and to make it your own, count on years.
It's a lifetime.
Yeah. So how did you then come, all of this must have been coming together in the same way that I think what is really happening to the field slowly as a whole. It's what you and Mike have already gone through, and that is the field as a whole is really looking at all of the pluses and minuses of the last 30 years, and they're saying, okay, this worked, we can keep this, this is really important, we've got to add a few other things here, we've got to get more integral, we've got to include I and we and it and all the quadrants, and we've got to include interior and exterior and states of consciousness as well as stages, and come up with integral transformative practice, which is what you and Mike did. So how did you start really consciously formulating an ITP?
81 and 82, I ran what we call a body transformation project.
Mm-hmm.
We said body because body is so often ignored, but this again was across the board.
Right.
And we kept records to some extent. We got these incredible changes, transformations of the body. We learned how to do affirmations. In fact, I've been working on affirmations since about 1978.
Mm-hmm.
I think we finally got it right. It took that long to get the affirmations right because, as you know, most affirmations don't work. But this is a really long-term study on how they work. And you'll see it in the, which you've read, the Life We Are Given.
Exactly. It's incorporated as part of the ITP training.
So all this stuff is building up to be incorporated in that.
Right.
Anyway, this one woman had been told by her doctor, don't even walk up the stairs fast. And they suggested an operation. And she said, I think I'll try this project. So I made her affirmations and worked with it for a period of a year, at the end of which she went back, and the doctor said, you can do anything you want to do. You can run a marathon. And we had other things like that. People doing something fairly trivial sounding, but some people like to be a little taller. And we got changes in height. We got all sorts of...
Didn't Mike get a change in his waist? Line.
Oh, yeah, he had a fantastic... That was actually after we started ITP, per se.
Yeah.
But all this is building up. Now, there is one key element that I've got to get into, and that is in 1989, I went just for my regular EKG stress test. So the traditional cardiologist said, well, you got to seem to have a slight blockage. I'd say it's in the right coronary artery, and it's not so serious, so... you know, you don't smoke. No, I don't ever smoke in my life. And you exercise. So that's fine. You go, keep on doing that. Come back in a year. We don't like to do the angiogram until just before the operation. And so I left, and those words kind of resonated in my mind. The operation, come back in a year. Is that all Western medicine has to offer us?
Yeah.
And so I'd met a guy named Dean Ornish, and he looked me up when he first moved out here. And so I finally, I called Dean. So I called him and said, come on over. I said, okay. And so actually we stayed with that program for 2.5 years. In fact, right up to the point when we started ITP. And therefore, I learned a lot there.
Yeah.
I learned what you can do with the program, what the different elements are. And we didn't want to do a program like the Ornish program. We wanted to do a householder's path. My own story there is, though, 13 months after I first started in the program, I went back on the same PET scan machine, and the cardiologist there reported that there's no blockage at all here. So in other words, in 13 months, I totally cleared up a mild blockage in the right coronary. Now, that's pretty convincing of what the group work will do.
Yeah, especially since it's supposed to be impossible, according to orthodox medicine.
At that time, it was impossible. Therefore,
yeah.
Very powerful change could take place.
So those became some of the components or modules in an overall ITP that you were starting to craft in your own mind.
Right. Well, in many ways, I made some big changes. For example, we did yoga, and it really didn't, it was not integral. You know, believe it or not, we did hatha yoga, but it was really not integral. And that's just one example. There were many examples in which we, I'd be really an idiot to say I made an improvement on yoga, and you can't do that. But yoga does have some problems. The current issue of Yoga Journal, the cover piece is on injuries.
Yeah.
People are getting injured everywhere. Nobody ever got injured doing avocado.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and also it had more in it. It had period of transformative imaging,
yeah,
where you would take your affirmations and really create powerful images. That was near the end.
Yeah.
And that's after you'd all also you'd already gone into this deep relaxation. So you get into this altered state, in a sense, the things that happen, the meditation response. You were already into the meditation before you started your meditation. It ended with meditation. And we just required just 10 minutes, but we recommended that people meditate as long as they want to.
Right, right.
And meditation, for me, certainly has never been so juicy as when followed by this series of exercises, this deep relaxation, this working with your affirmations. And by that time, you're already in the altered state that you get into meditation.
Right.
And the meditation is really juicy. You just don't want to stop.
Right, right. Now, when did you then start sort of more consciously, so to speak, or more intentionally hooking up with Mike and comparing notes and actually starting to craft something that you would be doing together?
Well, we always, you know, always compare notes.
Right,
always
work. Right.
The 1800-page, these are manuscript page, 1800-page version of The Future of the Body, I read twice. And, you know, nobody else, I did it for you. I did it for everybody else. No one else is ever going to have to do this. So in other words, I was in on that. Mike was, we always worked, but we had never actually literally done a program together. So I suggested to Mike, hey, why don't we do this? Why don't we do this integral transformative practice? We can, there's an empty space at the dojo on Saturday mornings, early Saturday mornings. We can start it there. And so, of course, I'd been reading The Future of the Body, and the last two chapters are about transformative practice,
yep,
guidelines for integral practice.
Right.
So he was doing it in an intellectual way, but I was doing it really in practical workshops.
So what was the date when you gave your first joint presentation?
Well, we started our first class. It was January the 4th, 1992.
Awesome.
We put the whole thing together. We put out in the Esalen catalog. It's jointly sponsored by Esalen Institute and Aikido Tamalpais.
Yeah.
So that's when we began our thing.
Well, see, there must have been some opening in the cosmos then, because I was writing Sex, Ecology, Spirituality.
I know.
The same, literally the same time.
Yeah, a lot of similarities. It's such an awesome piece of intellectual work.
Thank you. So that was all starting to come together.
We came up with some really amazing changes, really huge changes.
Yeah.
So then, of course, as you perhaps know, we made a presentation down at Stanford Medical School, and they are still working on the final statistics of a three-year study, which they did, $500,000 study.
Yeah.
So we wrote the book.
Right, The Life We Are Given.
The Life We Are Given.
And then it just really took off on its own almost, didn't it? I mean, there's at least 40 different ITP study groups and practice groups around the country based just on that book.
Yeah, it's not just around the country. I don't know if you've looked at our website.
Oh, I have. It's from all over the world.
I mean, they're from all over the world, the damnedest places.
Yeah.
How does it, you know where they, one place they're getting it from is from you.
I noticed that, which is I'm more than happy to see that happen.
You must have, did you have a Bulgarian edition?
I, you know, Bulgarian, Croatian, and every now and then I see people exactly from one of those fun places that my books are getting translated into, and they, for one of the first things they want to do is they want to start an ITP group.
Right.
So they go over and they find you and Mike, and off they go.
Yeah, it is spreading beyond. We just kind of put it out there in the world, and we kind of gave it away. Most people, when they get something new in this whole field, which is called New Age, unfortunately, as soon as they get one successful book, of course, they get branded, they get somebody to put them out, they put out these fancy brochures and start breaking in dough. So we just kind of gave this thing away.
Well,
go ahead and continue our work rather than just getting stuck at it at one point and making a lot of money.
What a great cycle, though. I mean, if you really look back on that trajectory over 40 years, from the 60s, actually almost before, but certainly from the 60s all the way up to the turn of the new millennia. And you starting out, and you and Mike together, but you also following your own sort of parallel tracks as well, and looking into the human potential movement stretching from the civil rights to environmental protection to interior development, and then culminating in a really beginning of an integral transformative practice. It's really quite an extraordinary story, my friend.
Yeah, it really is something, and the ITP, you know, what's wonderful about it is so simple and so ordinary.
Yeah.
People stop me on the street, I don't even know, they say, hey, that book is so wonderful. I said, what's so wonderful? It's just kind of common sense and ordinary. Yeah, but it's the way you guys put it together.
Well, and I have to also say, though, I'm not so sure how common sense it is, or we would have figured it out 40 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things that happens a lot. I hear this about my work a fair amount, which is, oh, that's so simple now. It's so easy. I get it now. But before you kind of see the importance of some of these things, it's not so simple. And then once you see it, you go, my God, how did we miss this? It really is obvious as hell. And I think that's part of what an integral practice is. You have to include self and culture and nature, and you have to include body and mind and spirit. And if you're not doing all of those, you're not being integral. Sounds unbelievably simple and obvious right now. But I think it took 40 years to figure that out.
Yeah.
As I say, to reach the state of ultimate simplicity is one of the great aims of art, isn't it?
Oh, exactly. And to be able to complete a life with an exclamation mark of simplicity has got to be an ideal, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know. When I'm teaching Aikido, I see people with... Aikido is extremely difficult. I see people, I will demonstrate something, and they're just making it so difficult for themselves. The whole key here is to simplify, to bring it down, to do less, not more. To finally get that final point of artistry where you do all that's needed to be done is done, and yet nothing more.